This is Jem.
And M.
From In Our Own World podcast.
My Cultura Podcast Network and Coca-Cola celebrate Hispanic Heritage Month with incredible content creators like Patty Rodriguez.
I was born in East LA, and I remember growing up, there was a small little shack in the apartment we lived at, and I would make that shack into a television studio. And there I would play pretend. I would pretend that I was a news reporter. And that's how I would spend most of my afternoons, pretending and imagining that one day I would be able to tell our own stories.
Listen to Out of the Shadows, hosted by Patty Rodriguez and Eric Galindo on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by Coca-Cola, proud sponsor of the My Cultura Podcast Network. Hispanic heritage is magic.
So you're in the garage working on your car, and you need the valves you bought last week. You look in the cabinets and on the shelves, but the parts are never in the right place. eBay Motors has the car parts you need. Over 122 million of them, all in one place, and all at the right prices. Find parts for everything from your classic coupe to your brand new truck at ebaymotors.com. Let's ride.
Soon millions will make Medicare coverage decisions for next year, and UnitedHealthcare can help you feel confident about your choices. For those eligible, Medicare annual enrollment runs from October 15th through December 7th. If you're working past age 65, you might be able to delay Medicare enrollment depending on your employer coverage. It can seem confusing, but it doesn't have to be. Visit UHCMedicareHealthPlans.com to learn more. United Healthcare, helping people live healthier lives.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we tell stories about everything here on this show, from the arts to sports and from business to history, and everything in between, including your stories. Send them to OurAmericanStories.com. Up next, a story from Emma McCormick. Emma is a Hillsdale graduate who decided to live somewhere interesting after graduating college because, in her words, she's a person who loves adventure and doing something new. Here's our own Monty Montgomery, himself a Hillsdale graduate, with a story.
The allure of the sea. It's hard not to deny it when it comes beckoning. If you've ever so much as looked at a boat, it's hard not to imagine what it'd be like to own one. One person who decided to make those dreams into reality is Emma McCormick, who did it on a whim, of course.
Well, my name is Emma, and I'm a financial analyst at General Motors. Right now, I'm a sailor. I grew up in Idaho. I, never even noticed sailboats. Didn't know anything about it. And then after college, when I moved to Detroit, I was new to the city. I didn't know anybody. And I was out for a run one day, and I saw a poster that said, "Free, no experience necessary, learn to sail." So that sounds perfect. It sounds like so much fun. And so I just showed up, and it was at a yacht club that had a race series, and they would take new people and just put you on a boat. I did some training and learning with them over the winter, and then sailed with them in every regatta I could.
But in 2020, Emma was told she'd be working remotely, and decided to make the most of it. If she could work remotely, she could live remotely too. But what to live in was the question she had to answer.
I thought about a sailboat for a fleeting second, but then I kind of doubted myself. I was like, I probably can't do that by myself. So then I thought about a van, and then I was talking to a sailing friend, and we were talking about the possibilities of doing that, but that was also pretty far-fetched. But then I was like, well, you know, I could probably just do this by myself. I don't know. It just seemed like more fun. And sailing is a lot more fun than driving. And it all came together really at the last minute. I canceled my lease before I had even officially bought a boat. The second hardest part about owning a boat is finding one to buy. Obviously, the first hardest part is maintaining the boat. All of them are going to have something wrong with them. I spent almost 2 full months searching, just looking into different types of boats. But I ended up finding this boat. I found it was listed on Craigslist, and the man who was selling it was 92. And he actually only bought the boat when he was 88.
And with the boat bought, she did what so many other people from the Midwest do when spring rolls around. she went to Florida. But what's her house like?
So it's 25 feet long. It's about 8.5 feet wide. The headroom is actually about 4 feet 9 inches, which means I can't stand up in my boat. Technically, 4 people could sleep on this boat. We've actually slept 5 for a few nights in a row. I had actually never slept on a boat until I bought this. I have a little galley or kitchen with a 2-burner alcohol stove. It's like your living room, your dining room, there's storage behind them. So yeah, I'm generally a pretty tidy person to begin with. I like things to be organized, which I think is good because living on a boat in such a small space where your living room, dining room, kitchen, bedroom, it's all the same. If you leave something sitting out, the whole place looks like a mess. So I think you just need to be prepared to put a lot of work into it. I mean, there's definitely people who live on boats here who put zero work into it, and their boats reflect that. But if you want to live somewhere nice, like, you got to maintain it. I think just be prepared for work, be prepared for things to take longer than you expect and cost more than you expect. But to move down here definitely simplified things a lot, down to like 1 pot and 1 pan and a handful of shirts.
So what's living in a marina like, and who are the kinds of people who spend time there? Unsurprisingly, they're a very eclectic group of people who certainly like to talk to Emma.
The sailing community, the boating community, everyone is so kind and so excited, and they, especially if you're younger, being around the marina, like, I can hardly go to the bathroom because there's bathrooms and showers and laundry and everything in the entrance lounge area to the marina. So I can hardly walk there without talking to somebody because there's always people out and about and there's always interesting people. And it probably depends on where you are. Like, I'm in the marina here, so maybe a little bit different clientele than people who just anchor in some random bayou. But I do love hearing people's stories and what brings them here. Like, one of my friends, like, broke up with his girlfriend, and so he just, like, wanted to move to a new state, do something different. And it's a fun life. There's several families with young kids, and they have day jobs. Like, I think one family I'm thinking of, the wife's a doctor, the husband runs a sail rigging company, and they've got their whole family lives on their catamaran.
But have any of her friends from up north come to visit? Of course they have.
Yeah, it's funny, I told all my friends, hey, I'm in Florida, I have a boat, it's warm and sunny, come visit. And I wasn't sure how many people would actually jump on that and buy a plane ticket and come down, but everyone I've told about it has. Like, I have guests basically every weekend, which is a ton of fun. Most of them have never been on sailboats, and so they love my boat until I show them a friend's boat that's bigger. But they're impressed.
And just a delightful piece, and a special thanks to Monty Montgomery for snagging it, and a special thanks to Emma McCormick for telling her story. She had some time to do remote work, and she did what so many Americans do. She pursued her own version of the American dream and decided to live on a sailboat in a beautiful marina in a beautiful part of the country where it was nice and warm. The story of Emma McCormick sailing away while doing her work here on Our American Stories. Folks, if you love the stories we tell about this great country, and especially the stories of America's rich past, know that all of our stories about American history, from war to politics to innovation, culture, and faith, are brought to us by the great folks at Hillsdale College, a place where students study all the things that are beautiful in life and all the things that are good in life. And if you can't get to Hillsdale, Hillsdale will come to you with their free and terrific online courses. Go to hillsdale.edu to learn more. And we continue here on Our American Stories, and our next story is about an American legend named Richard King. King's legacy can be seen on every tailgate and door of Ford's upscale F-Series trucks. The logo reads King Ranch. Here to tell the story of Richard King is Roger McGrath, author of Gunfighters, Highwaymen, and Vigilantes. A former U.S. Marine and former history professor at UCLA, Dr. McGrath has appeared on numerous History Channel documentaries and is a regular contributor to Our American Stories. Here's Roger McGrath.
The Cattle Kings of the Old West carved empires out of the wilderness. They were larger-than-life characters, bold, daring, intelligent, courageous, tough. They had great strength of character and iron wills. No Cattle King exhibited these characteristics more than Richard King. Born in New York City to Irish immigrant parents in 1824, Richard King is only 3 years old when his parents die and he is left in the care of an aunt. At 9 years old, he is apprenticed to a jeweler. The jeweler works him hard 6 days a week. On his day off, the young boy walks down to the docks of Manhattan and watches the ships come and go. He dreams of climbing aboard a ship and sailing off. At 12 years old, he does just that. Here's William Yancey, historian at Texas A&M University, Kingsville.
He ran away to the docks in New York City, and he snuck on board an ocean-going ship called the Desdemona, and he hid out in the hold of that ship for about 2 weeks, just scrounging whatever food he could get his hands on. Now, after 2 weeks, some sailors found him in the hold of that ship, and at this point, the ship was already well out to sea. So they grabbed him, brought him up to the captain. The captain asked him the question, "What is your name, boy?" And he immediately answered, "My name is Richard King, and you can either throw me overboard or put me to work, but I'm not going back." The captain seemed to be impressed by this young man's attitude, so he put him to work.
For the next several years, King works in a variety of capacities on several different ships. He demonstrates such intelligence, talent, and leadership that two different ship captains school him in navigation and command of a ship. By the time he is 16, he has a pilot's license and knows the Gulf Coast and the rivers of the Cotton Kingdom like the back of his hand. In 1842, King enlists for service in the Seminole War in Florida. It is during his Seminole War service that he meets Mifflin Kennedy, another ship's officer. King and Kennedy will become lifelong friends. Kennedy had been born in Pennsylvania and, like King, had first gone to sea as a cabin boy and worked his way up to become a ship's pilot. By 1843, Richard King has grown and matured. The 19-year-old is square-jawed, well-muscled, and tall for the times, at 5 feet 11 inches. When provoked, he can turn the air purple with profanity. That makes his friendship with the soft-spoken Quaker, Mifflin Kennedy, something of a surprise. In 1847, Richard King enlists for a second war, taking command of the ship Colonel Cross, and rises to rank of captain in the U.S. Navy during the Mexican War. King serves for the war's duration, transporting troops and supplies. He becomes intimately familiar with the Texas and Mexican coasts and with the Rio Grande River. It is during his service in the Mexican War that King recognizes steamship service would revolutionize the commerce of South Texas, especially the Rio Grande Valley. When the war ends, he buys the ship he commands as war surplus and is often steaming. King soon forms a partnership with his old friend, Mifflin Kennedy. By the mid-1850s, their company is operating more than two dozen ships, and thanks in part to their low rates, they are monopolizing shipping on the Rio Grande River. They will continue in this preeminent position for more than two decades. Here again is William Yancey.
In 1850, Captain King had been on a steamboat run to Rio Grande City and back. He had had a rough couple of days. He had had problems with his sailors. He had had problems with the engines on his steamboats. The final straw was when he got back to Brownsville. He went to moor his steamboat in the slip where he normally kept it, and somebody already had a boat there. Today, there was a steamboat in this slip. Now, everybody in Brownsville knew not to park their steamboats there because that was Richard King's slip, but today there's a steamboat there. Well, this sent him over the edge. He starts cursing a blue streak. Had to go down the river a little ways, found an empty slip to moor his boat, and he starts walking back towards this houseboat, and he's about to give the occupant of this houseboat a piece of his mind. Well, he never got a chance to do that. There was a young lady on the houseboat who had heard him, and she decided to confront him first. And the two walk towards each other, and this young lady says, essentially, who do you think you are using language like that? This is my father's houseboat. He has just as much right to be here as you do. Why don't you spend less time making a fool of yourself and more time washing your filthy boat? And at that, Richard King didn't really have a response. He's not someone who was left speechless very often, but this time he was left speechless. He turned around and he walked back to his boat. And then he and his sailor spent the rest of the afternoon washing that boat. Over the next several days, he couldn't get this young lady out of his mind. So he's going to go to his best friend and business partner, Mifflin Kennedy. So he goes to Kennedy and asks him, who's the young lady whose father's houseboat's parked in my slip? And Kennedy says, well, that's Miss Henrietta Chamberlain. Her father's the new Presbyterian minister in town. Kennedy said, there's only one way you're going to get to meet her, and that's if you start going to church with her. Well, over the next several weeks and months, he becomes a very faithful Presbyterian. He is there every time the doors of the church are open. And to make a long story short, he'll begin a 4-year courtship of Miss Henrietta. But eventually the two of them will be married in 1854 there in Brownsville. Her father performed the ceremony. The ceremony was at their church.
King takes risks when those with fainter hearts shy away. He steams sections of the Rio Grande where others think it impossible to go. He designs ships specifically for the fast currents and narrow bends of the river, enabling him to reach destinations previously considered impossibly remote. While dominating trade on the Rio Grande, King recognizes that much of the land of southwestern Texas would not support farming, but would be good for cattle. As a result, he begins to buy property, including the 53,000-acre Santa Gertrudis grant. He pays $1,800 for the grant, thought by many to be near worthless because recurrent droughts leave much of the area a wasteland.
In 1854, Captain Richard King is going to find some help for his cattle operation from an unlikely source. During the 1850s, he made several trips to Mexico to buy cattle to stock his ranch with. Now, one particular occasion, he went to a village called Cruillas, which was in the state of Tamaulipas, maybe 100 miles southwest of Matamoros. This village at the time was well known for its cattle herds and for its vaqueros or cowboys, but they were in the middle of a 3-year drought. All the grass was dead. There wasn't any water. The cattle were dying. So Richard King goes there, and he makes a pitch to the villagers because they own the herd in common, and he basically said to them, why don't you sell me your entire herd? And the villagers said, here's what we're willing to do. We're willing to sell you the entire herd if you'll take as many of us as want to go back to your ranch, and we'll work that herd for you. Well, that's a no-brainer, isn't it? He needs help. They need cattle to work. So about 100 villagers are going to come back to the ranch in Texas with Captain King at that point. They become the first vaqueros or cowboys on the ranch, and over time, they take a lot of pride in working for Captain King. They start to call themselves quineños, which roughly translated means king's men or king's people.
Whenever he can, King buys more land. His philosophy is simple: buy land and never sell.
And when we come back, we continue the story of Richard King here on Our American Stories.
Soon millions will make Medicare coverage decisions for next year, and UnitedHealthcare can help you feel confident about your choices. For those eligible, Medicare annual enrollment runs from October 15th through December 7th. If you're working past age 65, you might be able to delay Medicare enrollment depending on your employer coverage. It can seem confusing, but it doesn't have to be. Visit UHCMedicareHealthPlans.com to learn more. United Healthcare, helping people live healthier lives.
I know everything there is to know about running a coffee shop, but for small business insurance, I need my State Farm agent. They make sure my business stays piping hot, and I stay cool and confident. See, they're small business owners too, so they know how to help you best. State Farm is in your corner and on it. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Call your local State Farm agent for a quote today.
iHeartRadio and the Black Effect Podcast Network are sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. BetterHelp Online Therapy, a more convenient, affordable, and accessible way to try therapy. I'm Debbie Brown, host of the Dropping Gems podcast, a podcast about the depth and potential of personal growth and the human spirit, all in service to our liberation and internal peace. Go to betterhelp.com/blackeffect for 10% off your first month.
And we return to Our American Stories and the remarkable story of Cattle King Richard King. Let's continue where we last left off.
During the Civil War, Texas secedes from the Union, joins the Confederacy. Within months, the U.S. Navy effectively blockades the Gulf Coast, cutting off the South's greatest source of income, cotton exports. In these dire circumstances, King becomes one of the Confederacy's heroes, a blockade runner. He is so successful that he becomes a legend. It doesn't hurt that he is handsome and well-built. He becomes a real-life Rhett Butler. Union forces raid the King Ranch late in 1863 and loot and burn everything they can. However, their principal target, Richard King, escapes. And when the Confederates retake South Texas in 1864, King is back in business. With the Confederate surrender in April 1865, though, King slips into Mexico. King's story might have ended right there. But late in 1865, he secures a pardon from President Andrew Johnson and resumes all of his former activities. Here again is William Yancey, historian at Texas A&M University, Kingsville.
Now, it's not until 1867 before he really starts to reestablish his full-time cattle operation, and that just goes to show what good sense of timing the man had. Because around 1867, there started to develop a huge market for beef in the Northeast. As the Northeast becomes more industrialized, people are moving into cities, so they're not raising and growing their own food. You also have a large influx of immigrants from Europe. There is a need for beef. And Richard King becomes one of the first South Texas ranchers to realize that you can make quite a bit of money supplying that need. Now, at the time, there aren't very many railroads in Texas. So in order to get the beef to where it is needed, you have to walk them to where the railroads were. And that meant cattle drives. Richard King will become one of the first South Texas ranchers to drive cattle, specifically the Texas Longhorn, from his ranch in South Texas to railheads, first in Missouri and then later in Kansas. At the time, you could purchase Longhorns for between $2 to $4 a head in South Texas, sell them for around $20 a head in Fort Worth, maybe even as high as 40 by the time you got to Kansas. And Captain King was able to make a considerable amount of money doing this. Eventually, Longhorns, however, are going to fall out of favor in northeastern markets. The problem with Longhorns is their beef is very tough and stringy. And eventually, as railroads start to penetrate more of the country, it's easier for ranchers in other areas to raise better tasting breeds of beef, load them onto railroad cars, and ship them to slaughterhouses in Chicago for movement on to the east.
In 1869, he leads his first herd north on the long drive. For King, coming from his ranch in the extreme southwestern region of Texas, the drive to the Kansas railheads is more than 1,200 miles. Despite the length of the drive and losses to stampedes, swollen streams, and Indians, King makes enormous profits. From 1869 through 1884, King sends well more than 100,000 head of cattle to the railheads in Kansas or to ranges of the northern high plains. He continues to plow his profit back into cattle and land until he has hundreds of thousands of acres and tens of thousands of cattle. If Rhett Butler in Gone with the Wind is a Richard King-like character during the Civil War, then Tom Dunson is a Richard King-like character in Red River. King's great cattle operation is not without problems, which include regular cross-border raids by Mexican bandidos such as Juan Cortina and Juan Flores. In 3 years, King loses 33,000 head of cattle. He asks the state for help, but the governor refuses. In 1867, King begins to fence his huge ranch. At first, his crews put up wooden fences. After Bob Wire appears in 1874, the work goes faster. In 1883 alone, the ranch uses 190,000 pounds of Bob Wire. During the mid-1870s, King wages a personal war with Flores and his bandidos. Entirely at his own expense, King supplies Captain Lee McNally and his company of Texas Rangers with horses, food, and the latest Winchester rifles for pursuit of the bandidos. McNally is spectacularly successful, but not without controversy. He not only pursues the Mexican bandits through Texas, but right into Mexico. In Mexico, he destroys several bandido sanctuaries and defeats a Mexican army. While the U.S. government is apoplectic over McNally's border crossing, Richard King couldn't be happier. By the time of his death in 1885, King has increased the size of his ranch to 614,000 acres. And those are acres he actually owns rather than leases from the government. Following his instructions to buy land and never sell, his son-in-law, Robert Clayburgh, adds more acreage to the ranch until by the 1890s, the King Ranch is larger than the state of Rhode Island. Like the eastern industrial barons, King tries to control all businesses related to his ranching operation. He invests in railroads, feedlots, packing houses, ice plants, harbors, and ships. King, in many ways, is a king. To improve his longhorns, King brings in Durham bulls from Kentucky. His goal is to produce a steer with a longhorn's toughness and a Durham's bulk. Here again is Professor Yancey.
In 1940, the U.S. Department of Agriculture would recognize the Santa Gertrudis breed as the first breed of beef cattle produced in the Western Hemisphere, and really the first anywhere in the world in over 100 years.
In pursuing his dream, Richard King invents modern ranching. Farmers before him tended to raise cattle as a sideline. In the cities, fresh meat was a luxury few could afford. The King Ranch turns ranching into a big business. It also helps turn Americans into a nation of beef eaters. Richard King is a colorful character whose violent temper and wild, rough-hewn nature never diminish with age. King gets in several fights in his lifetime and seems to enjoy them. On one occasion, a big, angry cowboy exclaims to King that if he were not Captain King, the great cattle baron, he would not be able to get away with the profane remarks that he just made. King is no longer a young man, but the old cattleman explodes. Damn you! Forget the riches and the captain title, and let's fight. And fight they do. It is one of the best fights anybody can recall. The cowboy and the captain pummel each other with vicious blows for half an hour. Then, bloody and arm-weary, They shake hands. Thereafter, the cowboy says he will stand back to back with King, anywhere and any time. We tend to think of Hollywood's portrayals of the cattle kings of the Old West as exaggerated. Actually, a close look at Richard King demonstrates that such a classic Western as Red River and John Wayne's character of Tom Dunson told a tale no taller than the facts of the real life of Richard King.
And great job to Greg Hengler, and special thanks, as always, to Roger McGrath, author of Gunfighters, Highwaymen, and Vigilantes, and also a special shout-out to William Yancey, historian at Texas A&M University, Kingsville. Richard King's story, here on Our American Stories.
Soon millions will make Medicare coverage decisions for next year, and UnitedHealthcare can help you feel confident about your choices. For those eligible, Medicare annual enrollment runs from October 15th through December 7th. If you're working past age 65, you might be able to delay Medicare enrollment depending on your employer coverage. It can seem confusing, but it doesn't have to be. Visit UHCMedicareHealthPlans.com to learn more. United Healthcare, helping people live healthier lives.
I know everything there is to know about running a coffee shop, but for small business insurance, I need my State Farm agent. They make sure my business stays piping hot, and I stay cool and confident. See, they're small business owners too, so they know how to help you best. State Farm is in your corner and on it. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Call your local State Farm agent for a quote today.
iHeartRadio and the Black Effect Podcast Network are sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. BetterHelp Online Therapy, a more convenient, affordable, and accessible way to try therapy. I'm Debbie Brown, host of the Dropping Gems podcast, a podcast about the depth and potential of personal growth and the human spirit, all in service to our liberation and internal peace. Go to BetterHelp.com/Black Effect for 10% off your first month.
And we return to Our American Stories. Up next, we'll hear from our regular contributor in Iowa, Roger Rensch. He's here to share with us some memories about his time in competitive sports, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Take it away, Roger.
I think it was around 5th or 6th grade when my interest in sports began, and that interest would grow into a lifelong love. Before that, I was a chubby, clumsy kid, not very fast or strong. And in the summer between 6th and 7th grade, I shot up 6 inches to 6 feet tall, thinned out, and got pretty strong and coordinated. I went to Grace Lutheran School, and we had a great sports program and a network of Lutheran schools in Kansas City and eastern Kansas. I played flag football and basketball, and I was the star center on our team. I also liked baseball. In the summer after 7th grade, my mom signed me up for Little League. At our first practice, I didn't recognize a single face. Not only was I the new kid, but the rest of them had played together for years. The coaches had coached them since they were little. I was a rookie on a team of experienced stars. The next summer, I played in a different league on a team with friends from my school. And I had the opportunity to shine as one of our 2 starting pitchers. I had never pitched before, but I had this wicked curveball that couldn't be hit. It moved about a foot, and as the batters would see it coming at them, they'd back up off the plate, afraid to get hit. Then it would curve back over the plate, often for a strike, and I got dozens of strikeouts that summer. And it felt great to be a star again and be able to show what I could do. In 9th grade, things changed as I went to public school for the first time. I went from a small private school with about 8 kids in my class to West Junior High, where I had hundreds of classmates. And when it came to sports, I was in the big leagues now, with a lot more competition and bigger, faster, and stronger athletes. First came football. I wasn't very fast, but I could catch anything thrown near me. I was tall at 6'2", so they put me at tight end. I was also the punter and could kick it a good 40 yards pretty consistently. And I have two standout memories from that season. The first happened at practice one day, and I must have dropped a pass, flubbed a punt, or did something else to upset the coach, because we had this drill where one guy would line up against two other guys and try to fight his way through. Coach called my name, and then he called the names of the two biggest and meanest guys on our team to double-team me. Charles was the toughest guy on our team and could knock the snot out of people. And James was our biggest, heaviest guy. And I knew I was gonna get killed. So I did what any scared, skinny string bean would do in that situation and got creative. When we lined up and Coach blew the whistle, I dove straight down to the ground in the space between them and tried to crawl through. Now, when we did this drill, the whole team was watching, and boy, did I earn the comedy laughs for my efforts. The coach even enjoyed the entertainment, but unfortunately, he made me do it again and face my fear. And this time, Charles and James were licking their chops to get to me. I prepared for launch, and sure enough, when they hit me, I went flying in the air about 10 yards straight back. I think I still have a bruise on my behind today from that hit. But you know, I have to thank my coach, because I figured if I could survive that hit from those two monsters, I didn't have to be afraid of anything on the field. My other memory was in a game where we were playing a team that was beating us bad. We were backed up to our own 10-yard line, and it was fourth down. Time to punt. Again, for about the sixth or seventh time that game. So I came out to punt, and I'm standing right on the end zone line. James was lined up behind the line of scrimmage to block anyone who would try to get through and block the punt. They hiked me the ball, and as I stepped forward to kick it, James is backing up. And I kicked the ball right into his backside. It bounces back into the end zone, and the other team recovers it for a touchdown. Despite that moment, I really enjoyed my first season of tackle football, and it prepared me for the basketball season, where I tried out, made the team, and played with some of my football teammates. My basketball experience was quite different. We had 11 guys on the team, and they were all good. I was the 11th guy, the odd man out. So at practice, where we went 5-on-5, I didn't even get enough court time to learn the plays. We were good and won the city championship, so I did get to play in a few games where we had a big lead. But every day, I mostly just sat there watching at practice. I felt left out, and I didn't think the coach liked me. In the middle of the season, I made one of the worst decisions of my life. I quit. I didn't go to practice, and I didn't go talk to the coach. I just didn't show up. I let my teammates down, I let my coach down, and I let myself down. Quitting like that felt horrible. Way worse than any feeling of being left out. But I did it, and I learned from it. I made a decision later never to quit anything just because it wasn't going my way. That decision has served me well. In high school, I expanded my sports repertoire. I played football for a couple years, and that led to testing out another sport. The first day of football practice, our coach made us run a full mile in the high heat and humidity. It was about 100 degrees. By the end of the first lap, several of our speedy players passed me and were way ahead. But as the run went on, I passed them all back and ended up finishing first, about a half lap ahead of the next guy. That raised some eyebrows among my teammates and also my coaches. And one of them said to me, "That's impressive. You should try out for the cross-country team." So the next school year, I did just that. I ran well and made varsity. But in practice, after we'd go out and run several miles, which I loved, our coach made us go over to the track and run quarter and half miles, several of them, again and again, and I hated it. I couldn't see any point to it since we were running a 3-mile race in competition. I completely lost interest, and before the season started, I talked to the coach and told him, "Thanks, but no thanks." However, I loved long-distance running and kept doing it each day on my own, and 44 years later, I'm still doing it every day. In 1980, I went to St. John's College in Winfield, Kansas, a small school with only about 300 students. At St. John's, I played baseball my junior year. We only had one catcher. So in practice, I started warming up our pitchers and ended up becoming our backup. My shining moment came when we traveled to Atchison, Kansas for a weekend baseball tournament hosted by Benedictine College. The first night, our starting catcher went out and had a little too much fun, missing the curfew, so our coach sat him on the bench for the next game. And guess who got the start at catcher? I didn't expect that and was a little nervous, but I was also excited. Now, that game was against the host team, Benedictine. And on their team were a few of my teammates from that first Little League team I played on in Kansas City. Also in the audience that day was a pro scout checking out the small college talent. So the game started and it was pretty close. I didn't do anything spectacular, but did my job okay. Until about the fourth inning when the ball was popped up. Now, you know how when a ball is popped up, the catcher will throw off his face mask, look up to try to find the ball, and then run over to catch it? Well, I threw off my mask, and then with my other hand, I threw off my catcher's mitt too. A few seconds later, the razzing started. First, from a few of my friends on the other team who knew my name and were shouting it out of their dugout along with their jokes. Then, one of my own teammates brought down the house when he shouted for everyone to hear, "Hey, Raj, next time throw the shin guards." Both dugouts erupted in laughter. It was embarrassing. But I had to laugh too. So slowly, picked up my face mask and my glove, looked over at their dugout and then ours, then bowed before my audience. Some of them even stood and cheered. Needless to say, I never got a call from that pro scout. Despite blowing my opportunity to get called up for spring training, sports and athletics have always been a big part of my life. Along with running, I bike ride every day and lift weights two or three times a week. I always wanted to stay in shape to keep up with my kids, and I played all kinds of games and sports with them growing up. And now it's my grandkids' turn. In my lifetime, I've played many sports and games. I've experienced both the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat, along with a few humorous and embarrassing moments. Sports has helped me make friends, learn teamwork, and kept me in good physical shape. I'll keep running and playing as best as I can for as long as I can. And if I die doing it, it will be with a big smile on my face.
And a great job on the production by Madison. And a special thanks to Roger Wrench reminding us why we play sports. And it's for the fun. It's for the bonding. In high school, I was a captain of my basketball team. We had a good team. And I wasn't paying attention. We won the tip. I got the ball, raced for an easy layup in the other guy's basket. 2 points for the other team. Wrong Way Habib was my name for the next 2 years. Roger Wrench's story here on Our American Stories.
Soon millions will make Medicare coverage decisions for next year, and UnitedHealthcare can help you feel confident about your choices. For those eligible, Medicare annual enrollment runs from October 15th through December 7th. If you're working past age 65, you might be able to delay Medicare enrollment depending on your employer coverage. It can seem confusing, but it doesn't have to be. Visit UHCMedicareHealthPlans.com to learn more. UnitedHealthcare, helping people live healthier lives.
What up? It's Dramos. You may know me from the recap on LA TV. Now I've got my own podcast, Life as a Gringo, coming to you every Tuesday and Thursday. We'll be talking real and unapologetic about all things life, Latin culture, and everything in between from someone who's never quite fit in. Listen to Life as a Gringo on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
This is the start of a new era.
We have an opportunity to build a better future for everyone.
Combining the best of humanity and the technology, we will unleash our imagination.
Everything that can be connected will be connected.
We as an industry must dare to dream.
So we find ourselves at a critical juncture in human history.
See, touch, and experience the very latest in technology.
Meet us at MWC Las Vegas, September 28th through the 30th.